Hello and welcome to ELT Under the Covers. Today we have a new guest with us, but before we go to talk with our guest, we're going to have a few introductions. So I'm Neil of Team Teacher Fame, and I'm with my co-host.
You're not going to do the thing? Okay.
What's the thing?
Rich. Professor Rich. Well, normally you have an adjective beginning with R and you sort of say something rich beginning with R. Is that gone now? I moved on. This is season two.
We're moving on. It's season two now. Right. It's next level.
Okay. That's good. I greet that because I think, to be honest, we were flogging a dead horse with that one. All right. I'm Rich. YouTube.com/Professor Rich. Weekly live streams. Check it out.
And today we have a 15-year teaching veteran, a titan in teacher training and development, a task-based learning lumiere, one half of Dublin TEFL, Emma Mead Flynn. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Neil and Rich. Thanks for having me. It's a real pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. Totally our pleasure. So let's start off with the origin story.
Yeah.
Could you take us all the way back?
Story, yeah. Yeah. Having now got a child who's into, you know, such things. I'm a big fan, you know, of the origin story. So yeah, I think I have maybe some things in common with you guys, definitely. I started in Korea a long time ago. And I know, Neil, you've worked in Korea as well, right?
I have. I love Korea.
Yeah, I have to say, I went for the adventure. As I think a lot of people, you know, I'm an accidental TEFLer. I'm here 15 years later because I finished my degree and I knew that I didn't want to stick around Dublin at the time. But I had no idea what to do. I went to that, like, you know, careers fair day thing and all the lovely big, bright, shiny PricewaterhouseCooper, if they even, you know, all that stuff. I don't know if you guys, you know, can relate to that.
Finishing
the university thing, and it was, sorry, Richard.
No, I was reminiscing myself on those careers fairs. I remember, like, the two that I spoke to specifically was, like, someone offering a local journalism course, which actually ended up being the one that I took. And the other one I spoke to quite a lot was the prison service. Thank God I didn't go with them. The guy was really selling it, though, you know. He was just like, oh, the benefits and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, now, 20 years later, benefits, you know what I mean? Anyway, that's a whole other story, isn't it? So I you know, those career days just sort of left me a little bit cold. And I think I only went to two, to be honest, probably under duress from my parents, I would imagine. But I went to them. And the only stand that stood out for me was these two Irish women who had set up a company sending people, it sounds very... okay, because they had, you know, a kind of relationship with schools in Korea and all that kind of jazz. And I was at this particular careers fair with my very like-minded friends. It was three or four of us. And I think we all got the great idea at the same moment to sign up to it. More than 15 years later, maybe that's 18 years ago. 18 years later, I'm the only one still in it. But, like, it was probably the best random sign I've ever seen in my life, you know, because it did start something kind of cool for me, and certainly not something that I would have ever plotted out, because really what I really wanted to do was go back to university. I wasn't ready to leave. You know, I felt like I was being kicked out in a way. You know what I mean? I like, yeah, you're finished now, off you go. And in Ireland, I mean, this is kind of irrelevant but sort of important for me, was it was quite inexpensive to be a undergraduate student. So I had quite a lovely life. You know, there aren't big fees to pay here, or there weren't certainly at the time that I went to university. I worked, I had like kind of a steady income, great life. I did a double degree, just because I couldn't make a decision between two subjects. So I did English and I did psychology. I was learning loads, enjoying everything. And after 4 years, because I got 4 years to do my two degrees, I was just like, no, I'm not ready to go. But to do a master's in Ireland, you do need a lot of cash. Yeah. And I certainly hadn't saved any. So this Korea thing was like, so I can go and earn a load of money and then I can come back and go back to university. That sounds brilliant. I'll do that for a year. And then a year turned into kind of almost 18 months in Korea. You get that kind of year contract thing. I don't know if you had it the same, Neil, and they kind of ask you, do you want to extend? And about halfway through my first year, I mean, the first year was, it's really standard stuff. It's Hogwon, so academy, language academy. It's, you have kind of random classes, but a full timetable. You're teaching kindergarten maybe in the morning, middle school, all the way till 10 o'clock at night.
Yeah, you got to go, you go up with the ages, right?
Yeah, exactly. And they're there till 10. And, you know, it's this whole like cultural experience as well for me. It's just like eye-opening completely. And I loved that. I'd already traveled quite a bit. So I'm having a great time. And then I get offered 6 months into that kind of a bit more responsibility. And I do like a bit of responsibility. I like a bit of control, you know?
Yeah.
I like a bit of, would you like to run the kindergarten thing in the morning? Perk is you don't have to do that late night teaching anymore. Brilliant. Con is it starts at 6 a.m. but you have to, you know, you get a bit of control. You get to design the kind of program. And it just so happened that I'd been doing a bit of the kindergarten stuff and the very young learners stuff. And I'd been doing a lot of kind of what I didn't know at the time was project-based work, basically, with them. I mean, they're tinies. They're 3s and 4s.
Oh, so you're doing, like, crafts and, you know, like, coming up with little things. And, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, we're
That's
making,
awesome. That's what they need at that age. Exactly what they need.
Exactly, yeah. And it was very different, very kind of, very revolutionary, shall we call it. Now, there was a lot of reasons why I was doing that. One of them being that I didn't have to do much prep because, you know, bit of card and paper. So Emma, who gets up at 6 o'clock, well, 5 o'clock in the morning to go work at 6 o'clock, I could just about kind of do that. But then I sort of started to see the benefits of it. And loads of these kids are like quite affluent backgrounds, you know, to be sending your kids to these morning classes. You know, kindergarten, it's essentially daycare that starts really early with English. But anyway, like quite a lot of behavioral issues. I don't know if you experienced that too, kind of from like certain backgrounds would have a couple in the class. And suddenly this kind of project stuff was just like solving a whole load of problems that I didn't know it would. So yeah, again, another accidental. I feel like I'm a very accidental kind of careerer. I suddenly found myself working and becoming quite good at doing project stuff. It was a long time later that I reflected on that as being, that's what it's called. I think we used to call it crafting or something like that, you know?
Yeah.
Communication and crafting, we sold it as, or something like that at the time. And now people do that. And I've gone to amazing webinars and attended in Spain when I was based there. People who do that, like they train you how to do that. So I think there's definite value in it. Anyway, so got a bit of responsibility, hung around for a bit longer, stayed in Korea, but still, you know, kind of eye on the bank account to get back to university. The only problem was I couldn't figure out what I wanted to go back to. So it's like, do I want to go back and do like teaching? And that would always been like, but I'm not going to be a teacher. Yeah, I'm going to do English for my degree, but I'm not going to be a teacher. Yeah, I'm not going to, but that's just so like, so cliched. I'm not going to do that. So anyway, here I am.
What was the alternative? Was it author or writer? Writing?
Yeah. Obviously, the secret plan was to be, you know, a outstanding, world renowned and very respected journalist in what field? I'm not sure, but some field of journalism,
like gastronomy or travel or something.
Yeah, and something like really, you know, like really impressively. Kind of like, oh, Emma's a, wow, that's really impressive. Yeah. So again, no clear goal, like, so nothing really there. And there was no course. I wasn't coming back to do, you know, that course in that university. And so that sort of was another factor that affected me hanging around in Korea, getting a little bit of money. And then that great idea that I had when I was in university to go to Korea, I think is a long list of great ideas that I kind of aren't really my ideas in my career, but I see someone else do them and I know a good idea when I see them and I copy them. So the next great idea was that my best friend who had been living with me in Korea at the end of this 18 months was like, let's not stop this whole like travel teaching thing. Let's just keep it going. But let's go like get some qualifications because we didn't have any. So there's this thing called a CELTA. I'm going to do it in Hungary. And at this stage now, me and my best friend have fairly unhealthy relationship with each other because we've been in school together since we were about 11. And we've, you know, kind of tried to like leave each other at several points to make independent decisions, but we always find our way back to each other.
Oh, no.
So we're in Korea and we're like, yeah, we'll go traveling, we'll go home, and then we'll like definitely do something different. And yeah, meanwhile, like 6 months after coming home, we're both CELTA qualified. I went to London.
Yeah.
She stayed in Dublin. So I think, you know, we did diverge slightly. She stayed on in Dublin. I went to London. And again, I did my CELTA course with big plans to go abroad again. And at the end of my CELTA course, I got offered a job in London. And my big plans to go abroad were a deposit, back in the days when you could pay a deposit yeah. on a airfare to Buenos Aires, I think.
Oh.
Maybe Santiago, can't quite remember. I was definitely going. I had my £70 paid.
You
on
had
my
proof.
Ticket.
You had proof in your deposit.
Yeah. I had my ticket. And then I get this like call into the office at the end of the CELTA course, which went well. Mm-hmm. It wasn't, you know, for me, having taught for like quite a while in Korea, it wasn't the most challenging thing I had to do. It was very difficult to.
How did you find it? Because, you know, the CELTA's aimed at adults and you were more focused on kids. How did you find that?
I found that I had done kind of a lot of private work with basically kind of housewives in Korea. So I'd done a lot of conversation classes and I basically realized, that teaching was kind of like good teaching is like a really good conversation class where at the end they can all say they've learned a few things, you know, which weren't exactly like the conversation classes I was running in Korea. But definitely on reflection, I could kind of say that's what I think that's what communicative teaching means, maybe at that point in my career. You know, it was like I could recognize, like, probably it wasn't the turn the page with the middle schoolers and focus on a sound and then do a dialogue and then play a game where you throw a piece of wet paper at the board. Like, that probably wasn't, you know, do you know what I mean? Like, I could.
I don't know. I distinctly remember wet paper being thrown in my CELTA.
Yeah, really? Yeah, actually, having said that, I went on to
I'm joking,
work,
so my CELTA teacher probably just give me a slap. She's going to come in, coming over from Switzerland.
I mean, anyway, so there, sorry, I'm definitely, you know, digressing, but I'm finished a CELTA course and I get this offer, this job, and it's not really in line with these big, you know, Santiago, Buenos Aires, Emma goes to Latin America and does what? I don't know, but obviously has an amazing time. That it's not really like in line with that. However, I do have some friends in London who I had kind of been staying with and I quite liked their life. You know, they were kind of temping and doing other stuff, and like Tefling and temping are not a million miles away from each other, you know. Mm-hmm. So I hung on, and that was 10 years.
Wow.
10 years that went on for. In that time, I happened to find myself in this school that I got this job offer in, you know, where I did my CELTA. It was just one of those schools where you do your CELTA, you start teaching, you know, you kind of prove, you know, you prove that you're in it, which I happened to be in it. I really loved it, it turned out. You know, I was kind of good at it. It wasn't a massive strain on my life and I still got to enjoy myself. And then like 2 years later, you're kind of training, you're doing a bit of teacher training for, I wasn't CELTA qualified yet, but you're doing kind of a bit of teacher training for teachers who maybe are looking to do like a 1 week course in the summer. And then from there you go on, I did my CELTA. From my CELTA, I went on to become a CELTA trainer. A couple of years later, I'm working more in different kind of training. Like, I'm designing training courses. And then like a couple of years after that, I'm a CELTA trainer. So it's like, that's the kind of school I was in. You know what I mean? It's just like super development, super opportunity. And 10 years later, I'm like, okay, maybe London is done, you know, maybe that's
so
maybe
you spent 10 years in London.
In London,
was that teaching adults or teaching kids,
so
or
I
range?
Was doing the whole shebang, really, because we had that cycle where, you know, it's like general English exams, mm-hmm. business classes, that's how your timetable was built. And then you'd have regular influxes of kind of closed groups. So I would teach Japanese. A Japanese group twice a year would come. I would teach them. Some Spanish kids would come. I would teach them. And we had a couple of groups of Taiwanese kids. I'm talking about like teens as well. Come teach them. So I got this kind of interesting, really mixed experience as a teacher. of teaching quite a range of things. Just like really, really lucky, I suppose, as well as a trainer, because it really informed me as a trainer to help teachers now, especially. I can reflect back on that in spite of having lived somewhere like London, which is might not present a lot of opportunities. I can look back and go, oh yeah, yeah, I've taught like a closed group of monolingual teens, you know, I've done that. I remember what that's like, and I did that for a month every summer. So that was kind of London. But I think by the end of it, things had started to move online in the world, because that was now 7 years ago. I know we might not be able to kind of reflect on that very, everyone thinks it all happened last year, you know, but about 8 years ago, seven, 8 years ago, things started to move online. Things like the CELT, of course, started to move online. And I started to work on those kind of things, especially because I decided to leave London, but I wasn't sure where I was going. So I
that was more or less when you started Professor Rich, right?
It was about then, wasn't it?
I think it was about nine
years ago when I started.
Was it?
That's my YouTube channel that was probably more successful then than it is now.
Right.
It's like a graveyard now, but back then I think I was an early adopter and it went quite well for me.
Yeah.
And now you've got English with Lucy and all those lot, right? And they've kind of conquered YouTube.
Yeah, but it was that kind of time, you know, that I think we're talking about the same kind of period. And I don't know, like, what happened first, whether I got this bug to travel or I got offered the opportunities to travel. But something happened and I found myself in Saudi, back in Dublin, in Spain, doing bits and pieces, like a month's course here. And I was designing for online work more. And I suddenly was like, this is what I want to do. Mm-hmm. And then I made the jump to move to Spain permanently, kind of after a year of doing that, kind of around the world, so to speak, but mostly actually online, but, you know, helping people in a lot of remote places. And then, moved to Spain and kind of focused solely really on working with teachers at that point. And that's when I moved to Spain, that's when I still teach as much as I can, but as much as I can teach now is like not very much, you know, a couple of private students. So I'm very much more in the
I find that an interesting thing, actually, kind of keeping a foot in the door kind of thing, or something like that, keeping a dog in the game, because I think some people like to do it and some people don't, right? Because you definitely get people who kind of, once they move into teacher training or materials, like, that's the end of teaching for them, you know. But you get other people who definitely keep their foot in the door. I mean, I think I imagine that I'll always do the occasional bit of teaching. And the company that I work with a lot at the moment, the guy who runs that company, and they do all kinds of stuff. They've got a huge, successful YouTube channel. They've got online classes. They've got this fancy website. Like, they're very good, like, well-established online company. And he still teaches. He still teaches, you know, not a great deal, but, you know, you can book him on his own website, like 5 or 6 hours a week. And I just think, with all of that other stuff he's doing, you know, I think the motivation for that must be similar to your motivations. You know, it's kind of just keeping your, I imagine it's something about sort of keeping your mind in the game or something.
Yeah, I would feel really inauthentic personally, just personally. I would feel really inauthentic trying to help teachers do things if I wasn't doing things. I think it's not any trainer's fault, so to speak, that happens. But I know a lot of people who kind of, because of their timetables and the institutions they work for, that's where they find themselves. They find themselves doing back-to-back training and just like not really connected to the classroom as a practitioner, as an observer. They're in the classroom a lot, but that's a very different thing. And I think it's where training can be improved as in a profession. We can be better at helping teachers by putting ourselves into their shoes, no? Because that's where things get a bit disconnected, you know, when I deliver like my training course that I've designed, but I have no idea like what people are doing.
Right.
You know, the teaching, the day-to-day, what that involves. And I can't say that I know the day-to-day as much, but I have a couple of lessons. I have a couple of classes with learners. Yeah. And I do teach, we teach a group on our dip, and I teach them as much as I can. I teach them every probably 4 weeks. I teach them for a couple of hours. So it's a one class a week. Sorry, it's a very long course that the teaching practice goes one day a week. But I, you know, whenever a slot comes free, I'll throw my hand in the ring to teach it. I'm like, I'll teach it. I'd like to teach that. So, but yeah.
That's kind of good as well. I guess it kind of means that they sort of get to know you. So when you're sort of sitting in the corner taking notes and stuff, then it's a little bit less awkward, I suppose.
Yeah, for sure. I think you have to put yourself under the microscope as a trainer and as someone who wants to help teachers.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I think, yeah, it should. That is something that should be done a little bit more. Because I remember years ago someone kind of raving a bit about how they'd seen, and I don't know when or where this happened, and we didn't actually ask Jamie about this, but that they'd seen like Jamie Keddy basically taught a class at like a conference, and he just literally had the class and then all these teachers sat around the outside, and they said, you know, it was sort of warts and all. And I think a lot of people kind of, you know, felt that that was quite a respectable thing to do, because no one's going to expect you to then give a perfect class in front of all these kind of experienced, you know, fancy teachers and whatnot.
I think there might have been Innovate ELT. They did that a lot. I've seen a couple of Kerry Jones. I saw do that, and I remember that was quite formative for me, seeing someone like Kerry Jones. He's just someone I really look up to and have learned a lot from. Just the teaching in front of me, it's like, wow, this is the stuff, you know. for me, you know, that was. And I think that's important to have that as a trainer as well, that there's people that I want to see teach or want to see. I mean, the ideal for me would be that I get to see people train, but that's a very closed door experience. But but certainly we can share as a community, trainers, we can share our practices more, and people are sharing their practices more, you know, to help each other develop.
Yeah, well, I guess it's probably a bit of a can of worms, that, isn't it? Because then you've got all of the certification, you know, with Trinity and whatnot. And we were talking a bit about this with John Kay, you know, and he was saying how he used to have extensive arguments with the invigilators about, you know, the invigilator would say, oh, but, you know, they didn't have a language point. You know, and he'd say, you know, did you not watch the lesson? And kind of have this sort of argument about, you know, sort of the box ticking versus the reality kind of thing. But but he said as he's got older, he's learned to kind of just step back and just nod his head and say, yeah, okay.
I know it's the real dark side, I think, of training is assessment and criteria meeting. And I'm definitely, when I say guilty, or I'm definitely in that boat of like, when the assessor's there, when the examiner's there, we'll do what we need to do. But the training you've received from me, from the organization, from the course, that is like not, it's a bigger thing than just that, what I'm showing the assessor. But I will help you make that assessor be very happy. Does that make sense? But I'm not only going to help you make that assessor be very happy, I'm also going to help you as a whole teacher.
I think that's probably the right attitude. I would say so. I mean, the things that whether I got from the out of the dip were definitely the kind of opportunity to do new things, you know. And you know, the easy option is to play it safe, but I certainly felt when I took it with Oxford TEFL, like, that I was encouraged to try different things and new things.
Definitely.
That was brilliant. And I think that's what it should all be about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's tricky with the qualifications.
Yeah, you it's just kind of an institutional thing with education, where you just generally, is not even teach training, but when you're teaching as well, you could just lead into teaching to the test. And, you know, that's what you kind of see a lot in the public school system. It's, you know, and that's what a lot of teachers complain about there, is, you know, they don't feel like they're teaching. They're just teaching to help the kids, you know, get their GCSEs or, you know, whatever is the standard in that particular country. But, you know, does it help anyone? It's such a tightrope, because we want to make sure that, you know, the kids or the learners are actually learning, so, you know, we can change or, you know, improve upon the teaching, but also at the same time, it's, you know, taking away a lot of agency from the teachers. It's hugely important, because if we don't have agency as teachers, then we don't get these unique approaches. like yeah. the Jamies and the John Kays yeah. with the poetry, and you know, yeah. like yourself, you were kind of given it a lot of agency and career with the kindergarten. I know it kind of started out yeah. as I'm just trying to make it easy for myself in a way,
yeah, but yeah, then yeah.
it just yeah. it, that's what kind of worked, and then you've built upon that. So you know, yeah. it's a learning process, and it's just unfortunately there's no way to kind of assess if this teacher's heart is in the right place. It's yeah, it's just if their learners are progressing, and I think a lot of it comes down to that. If the teacher is just kind of trying to push the boat forward, or yeah. are they actually invested?
I know this whole empowerment of teachers, I think it's a, I mean, I don't want to be too cynical about why we don't empower teachers, but I do think there's sort of compounded issues around trust in teachers, especially in TEFL teachers and as a profession. I mean, all of this stuff is kind of connected together. So this is a little bit of my kind of brain vomit now, you might call it, guys, but it's like, if we trusted teachers a bit more, some of those things might happen better. Like we would, you know, have teachers who are more willing to experiment, and if we gave them more power and control. But the reason we don't is because as an industry, the TEFL, you know, the English teachers of this world, we have a really bad rep. You know, the profession has a bad rep, and yep. we don't help, not we, us three, but the profession. And you know, there's a lot of those forces you might talk about that kind of control us, but some of the market forces are really ugly, you know, and they mm. kind of keep us in a place of disempowerment. Yeah. Right. But yeah, this is like I'm getting off my socialist, you know.
no, but it's kind of true.
But you know, yeah, there's stuff going on there that we could, yeah, if we could only, not only if we can, because if only sounds like we can't, but I think we can help teachers. Small steps, like you say, Neil, mm. like just let them do a bit more experimentation with things like video telling, storytelling, poetry, but there's definite fear, I think, of destabilizing what that might do to
the yeah because there's I do see the other side as well, because I realized that I was as you coined it, an accidental TEFLer, and I just happened to have an innate I need to do well at a job just for my mm-hmm. own sanity. Yeah. But not everyone has that. So you might have an accidental TEFLer that's just, well, I can get by on my charisma, and as often people talked about in China, being a dancing monkey, which obviously mm. doesn't help learners. So there's kind of like smoke where there's fire. And
yeah.
so I understand why there can be a push to standardize, or even a push by schools to follow the curriculum, because then they yeah. know that the students are learning. But mm-hmm. it's yeah. I don't know how you kind of resolve that, to be honest. That's kind of one of the things that yeah. we're exploring with the LT.
You know, I've always thought that, like, and I thought this years ago as well, I've always thought that, like, and it probably wouldn't even fix the problem, but I used to think that some sort of trip advisor for language schools might be helpful. But now thinking about it, then you've still got the idea of, because it is possible to, you know, we know, especially as experienced teachers, it's possible to pull the wool over the students' eyes. Mm-hmm. You can definitely make students think they're having good language classes mm-hmm. when they're not, right? And, you know, it's like you say, Neil, you know, you get the colours, the fireworks, the flashy this, that and the other. And you get students coming up to you saying, oh, he's such a good teacher. Oh, I really love blah, blah, blah. And you kind of know who they're talking about, and maybe you've listened to their lessons, right? And it's kind of like them kind of monologue entertaining the students for 60 minutes, you know, and you kind of think, are they a good teacher, or do they just like them as a person, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So then they, even if we had a trip advisor for language schools, then it might be a case that you'd get the kind of, you know, the whatever, the Walmarts or the McDonald's getting the high ratings, you know, or whatever.
Yeah.
So what we really need is like a Michelin guide.
Yeah. Yeah.
We could call it yeah. the Richeling Guide, and you can write it with Emma. Terrible pun. I can't help it. Sorry.
We need someone like Scott Thornbury or something to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah.
So you were in Spain, in Barcelona, and everything was going well. And and now, where are we at now?
Now we're a little bit forward from that. So we were there for a while, and things were good. And then this thing called COVID happened. I don't know if you heard about it, but
like a type of bird.
I think loads of things happened. We were thinking about where we, you know, that whole, I don't know if you do that, like I do 5-year blocks in my life. So we'd been kind of thinking about the next 5 years anyway, but anyway, something called COVID came along and pushed us along a little bit. We were freelancing. So I'm saying we, sorry, my husband and I, we kind of work as a bit of a unit, especially being parents in the whole TEFL industry. I think sometimes, if he wasn't in TEFL, I think I definitely wouldn't be able to do as much. So we were there and everything kind of fell from underneath us in terms of what the next 5 years were, because the next 5 years we're going to be working remotely with a school in Barcelona, where we had kind of, I suppose, if you like, put all our chips in, because we were freelance for a really long time. And I think being freelance is brilliant and I loved it so much. And then we threw all our chips in and then the school collapsed. So we were chipless, you might say. Mm. And so needs must, etc. Plus something that I've always wanted to do is become a kind of my own. I mean, as I go back to the career story, be a bit more in control of things myself. I do like it. Mm-hmm. So we started a business. Yeah. And I think for us, this whole online thing that everyone else felt forced into, was forced into. For us, it's something that we've been doing for a long time, and something we see massive value in, and we're massive like kind of proponents of an online mode for people who want to work in the online mode, not as an emergency stopgap. You know, we don't see it like that. Mm-hmm. And so this allowed us, I suppose, because everybody was going online, I think more people were discovering it. It's like the secret, you know, that you didn't know existed but was out there. And it's that whole thing. It's like some people jumped online and were like, this is fab, I love it. And those people want to keep working online. So what we've done is we've basically, set up an online school to help develop teachers who do want to work sustainably in an online mode. That's not to say we're not helping face-to-face kind of teachers as well. We are, but we're kind of interested in supporting teachers who want to do this thing, this online thing properly, so to speak, you know?
And what's the name of this school? And how can they get in touch?
Yeah, so the school's called Dublin TEFL, and the website is www.dublinteffel.com. And we were kind of impressed that it wasn't already gone as a name when we popped it in the search. That's us. And we are mainly at the moment providing DIP TESOL courses. So that's something that, Sean and I have lots of experience from our freelance days, being DIP tutors. Rich knows a little bit more about that.
It's interesting. Because you've sort of started this business, you know, like you say, in the middle of the pandemic. Obviously, the online element's a big thing. Yeah, that's great. Have you found there's been a lot of custom? Because I actually feel a little bit detached from the sort of the teachers at the ground level at the moment, because I'm not seeing them. I'm not going into a school, So the people I'm talking to are just kind of colleagues from the past who are, you know, now sort of teacher trainers and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. So I don't really know what's going on at that level at the moment.
Yeah. I mean, we're not working with closed groups. So we're working with teachers who are working in really different contexts. You know, we have like exam teachers, predominantly in exam teachers. We have some teachers who are working, for example, in like on platforms, working with China a lot. We have teachers who are working in countries like Spain and Italy in that like hybrid mode, which is really common now, you know, where you've like half your learners online and half your learners in the classroom.
Yeah, John Kay mentioned that. He said a lot of the students who'd come in person had made comments suggesting that they weren't too keen on it and that they wanted to know if they came back again that they'd get that they wouldn't be involved in a hybrid class. That's just a side comment.
Yeah. The hybrid thing is, well, I mean, the first word that springs to mind is just, well, weird for me, because like it's a whole, because also the word hybrid, I find quite an unusual word. It's like a kind of curious word. Now it's kind of a curious thing. Hybrid, what is this? And but this idea of like half 50-50 is so challenging for teachers. It's incredibly challenging. I'm working with teachers at the moment who are doing their projects, you know, on the dip, and they're trying to work with things like agency and engagement and autonomy in the hybrid classroom. And it's like, yeah, that's some hard stuff to be dealing with, you know, where and one of my teachers, you know, I've seen her in her full get up. Like, it's like some kind of, I don't know, telesales proper, you know, like full headgear, like working the audience, working the screen. Like, it's really impressive, but it's a whole lot of skills. You talk about new skills, like that is a whole load of skills that I certainly wouldn't be stepping into that situation.
Is it possible to do the dip and have a purely online class?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that is possible. Okay.
It is. Yeah, it's possible. Yeah, they've opened up a lot more. They opened up a lot more quickly than Cambridge, even Trinity did. I think kind of Cambridge are coming round to it, but I think Trinity are really forward thinking, and that's what, for me, that's what it's all about, choosing to run a dip, because we did have a choice. You know, do we go with Delta or dip?
Yeah.
Being, I'm a Delta tutor as well, and have been for a long time. One thing I love the dip for how forward thinking it is, forward facing for teachers. You know, it's all about where you want to be, where you want to go, how you want to use what you're doing to help you and in
that's,
your
That's why
career.
I took it at the time as well. Everyone was talking about that. You know, when I decided to go for the dip, they were all saying, "Oh yeah, go for the dip. The dip's the one that's got a bit more focus on this, that, and the other."
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but yeah, I mean, the question was about being connected to teachers. I mean, I feel very connected to teaching through the teachers that I'm working with, who are just working in like really different contexts, and most of them online or hybrid, as I say. But it's a hard world out there, you know, online at the moment. It's a really tough, really tough world.
Well, that it's kind of meant that these worlds have converged, because before it was very, there are online teachers and there are local, you know, in the country teachers. And often what you have is that the local in-country teachers are either going to be, you know, those accidental TEFLers that are traveling around, the backpack teachers, or very qualified, very experienced teachers in esteemed schools and such. And then you've got online teachers that often, you know, could be like YouTubers that are just not even doing classes, but are just teaching English. But, you know, we still kind of consider them teachers. And then we have those that are doing online classes. Normally, they're through a platform, in my experience, like VIP Kids or Magic Ears, you know, these China-based ones, or even ones in Korea, where, all of these. And, you know, often they're not teachers. They're just, you know, people that are doing it as they're like Uber teachers, kind of, in a way.
But then now,
all those local ones are coming into the online space and they're competing with the online ones. We're all teachers. There's what is the crossover? What's the conversation? How does it all fit?
I completely went through that because I was looking for academic management jobs at the time, and then when the pandemic hit, and I even went for a few interviews and was like, oh, let's see, you know, and then suddenly it's like everything closed down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I heard back from those interviews, it's like, we're not hiring, as you might imagine. You know, we'll get back to you when this is all over in a couple of weeks or whatever. So then I kind of started fishing around online. And the first places that I come up against were those big platforms. And that really is the kind of TripAdvisor style teaching, isn't it? It's who can sell it to the students best. And they're the ones who are charging like 60 quid an hour or more. And you don't really know what qualifications they have, but mm-hmm. they've got loads of good ratings. Mm-hmm. And then at the bottom of the pile, you've got the people charging just ridiculously small amounts of mm-hmm. money, you know, like, you know, almost kind of less than minimum wage, really. Yep. And I went through the kind of hiring process for one of those companies because mm-hmm. I thought, well, I'm going to have to go online. And I, you know, I put loads of things out at once. And one of the things I went through was the process of them. And it was quite interesting. They had this Zoom call. I can't remember the name of the company and I don't particularly want to say it anyway, but they had this Zoom call and, you know, they left it ambiguous what this Zoom call would be. I thought it'd be like an interview. And, you know, I kind of showed up to it quite casually because I was already not that particularly mm-hmm. that keen on this particular going into that kind of world where it's kind of very dog eat dog. And it was a Zoom call with like 100 other teachers. Like they just had them all there. And they obviously hadn't told anyone. Some people had notepads and stuff like that. And one of the first things they said, the host was like, look, nobody knows who you are as a teacher. Nobody knows if you've been teaching for 20 years. Nobody knows what qualifications you've got. So, you know, you can't sort of come in here and expect to be, you know, to kind of have that. You have to kind of come in. And he was, you know, he was saying like the people who come onto our platform and are successful, like, you know, they'll start off at the ground level and it'll be hard work for a couple of months. You know, they build up the reputation and then they kind of move up from there. So it's kind of like this whole thing of starting from scratch, you know, and as soon as he said that, I was just like, no, thanks. Like, I'm not going there again, you know. And very luckily I found this this other company who kind of already had an established clientele and they're selective mm-hmm. about the teachers they hire and stuff, and that worked for me. But you know, I'm quite thankful that I didn't have to get involved in all that. And I can imagine for a lot of people it must be a nightmare, you know.
If that's where you had to go. Devaluing as well, you know, for just really devaluing and the sense as professionals, you know. And I don't use that word lightly, because I think when you are in it and you've been in it, it doesn't matter what kind of, I mean, we can talk about qualifications, but I think professionalism is a state of mind, you know, that mm-hmm. we have about our jobs. And Neil, you were saying about, like, you know, you want to do a good job. It's just like, it's massively problematic to again, the future of our industry. Not, you know, at the moment I think it's all a bit like the self-organizing system, but it's like I'm a bit worried about how the self-organization is going to work out in the future and where it's going to lead to or leave people. And that's a real concern.
I mean, in a way you could take it as far as just education in general. It's quite it's quite difficult to kind of objectively say mm-hmm. what's a good teacher, what's a bad teacher, and how do you measure that.
Yeah, but I think, like, for us, in if I bring it back to this whole thing of what we see as the whole point of helping teachers online, it's like, you know, you can be a teacher on those platforms and you can do your whatever, rock up, rock out, you know, as we used to have. I remember teachers who used to do the same in the face-to-face context. You know, they were clock in, they rocked up 2 minutes before their lesson, they were out the door as soon as, like, the you know, imaginary bell rang or whatever. You can be that if you want to. But that's what you're going to get, you know what I mean? Or you can be like a more, I suppose, informed teacher, like in the online mode. I mean, like, you can be, you can learn about things like course design, you know, you can learn how to set up your own platform. And when I say platform, I don't mean, you know, like something fancy. I just mean something using a free and general access tool that you can build a course. You can have your own learners, you can teach groups, you can teach individuals. And you can do this if this is what you want to do. And I think that's really important for teachers to know. Like, that's not the only option. You don't have to go down that mm-hmm. that the Uber or the Uberfication of TEFL route, as I've heard it's called. I think it's important.
That's a good term for it, yeah.
Yeah, I'm in a community, and that was kind of floated as a topic this week. And I think it kind of worries people. It worries people on loads of levels, but there's so many things we think we can do in our profession to help ourselves and not future-proof completely, but certainly support ourselves as professionals in the industry.
How would you suggest someone to go about setting up that? Because I think that's kind of the stumbling point for people is it's... Where do you even begin?
Uh-huh. Well, I think, so if you take like a teacher who has some experience, because again, I do think, you know, the reason that CELTA exists, for example, is to help teachers who don't have any qualifications or experience to become certified and to understand things. But let's say a teacher does have a bit of something. Yeah. So they've done their CELTA and they've worked in maybe one of these platforms, or maybe they've worked in the in the face-to-face mode. Maybe they're free, but they're like, I want to do this. I want to set stuff up. I think there's two things that they need. One of them is they need to have a clear idea of what they want to do. So like, do they want to teach groups? Yeah. And if they want to teach groups, great. Do they know how to teach groups? Yeah. So they need to kind of understand that. Yeah. It's not like you can't just sort of send out into the universe, can I get some students? And I think I don't think that works. But even more specifically than like, what do I want to do with that strand of, it's something that I was reading recently as well about, is the future of English teaching is not really general English. The future of English teaching is niche teaching, because niche teaching is about, it's about all the things that are important about teaching. It's about having clear goals for learners having clear goals, you know, resources being tailored and motivation being higher. All these things are super important. And niche teaching is all about that. So when I say who you want to teach, if you're, you know, CELTA qualified, couple of maybe years experience, or even not that much, who do you want to teach? Do you want to teach doctors? Because you've got a background in medicine in some way, maybe you've done like some medical training yourself. Do you want to teach business? Do you want to help people who are in, you know, sort of, I don't know, setting up their own business and want to work in English? Do you want to work with those people? Do you want to work with engineers? Have you got an engineering background? So the first thing, I'm being really specific now, but that's kind of where it's at, you know, who do you want to teach? And maybe you make a list of like a load of people that you could teach. Like, for example, I couldn't really teach medical English at the moment, so that's not going to be on my list. Yeah, but I could definitely teach exams. I know exams. I could teach kids. So I'd make my list of things that I want to teach. And then for each of those things, you have to look at where you're going to find those learners. And like, there are places you'll find those learners. Yeah. So if you want to work with, if you're maybe got a background in engineering or something like this, you can go and you can approach universities, you can approach in on LinkedIn, you can approach organizations. You know, you got to have like a plan, you know, you got to be a bit businessy about it. I know I'm getting pretty pretty detailed, but that's how you get students. You don't get students by kind of just like saying, I want to have some students.
You often idea that you just put up something in whatever country classified that you're aiming for, and you know, they're gonna come to you. You build the field and they will come.
Exactly.
It doesn't work that way. And often as well, is you are stuck because there's a language boundary. So especially with other there's a language boundary with the people that you're actually trying to get hired by. You know, they might not even be able to read your ad. And then there's barriers between countries like China. There's no Twitter. You know, you're going to have to learn how to use WeChat. How are you going to post in WeChat, because it's all group based? And you know, I've got videos on that, and on Team Teach China on our YouTube about what you do with that. But it's a very nuanced, and each country's nuanced, and there are definitely loads
super
of boundaries.
Tailored,
So I think is excellent advice, because if you're contacting institutions, you are most likely going to be able to have someone at least with a higher level of English that can kind of consider this offer, and especially if you know, sell it well. And I think now that is going to be an important skill of being a teacher. Is being a business owner, which means being able to sell, being able to do all that administration.
And there's so much brilliant, brilliant free stuff out there, like just amazing stuff that you can sign up for to help you in that, like strategizing, you know, like social media presence, how to, you know, all these things that I've learned, like things called lead magnets. I didn't know what a lead magnet was, you know, 12 months ago. Now I know what a lead magnet is. But you know what I mean? It's like, as if you want to do this and you want to be a teacher and you want to have your control, you have to learn some stuff, you know? And you have to have your little plan. Like, you have to have your website, whether it's whatever it is, or your presence and all those things. It's a bit like your you know, your CV used to be, but CVs are not what you need in the online mode. But we work, we have a teacher on our dip at the moment, and she's set up her own school in the States, you know. She's doing great. She's doing better than she needs to be doing, you know. I mean, it's possible. These things are possible, but they take a bit of time, a bit of thought, I think, a bit of creativity as well.
It's funny because we were speaking to Nicola Meldrum the other day. I don't know if you saw that one up recently. And, you know, this actually came up and she said, you know, maybe we need to start incorporating this on our teacher training courses, some idea of the actual practicalities of teaching these days, because, you know, so many teachers were unprepared for it.
Yeah.
You know, it's like hitting a brick wall kind of thing. And you know, there are elements of that now, I definitely, and this idea of niche teaching as well, and I think as well, I'm kind of inclined to think that it's not just about niches in terms of who your students might be in an English language classroom, but also what makes your English language classroom unique, because you know, there is an element of English language teaching where people, you know, one motivating factor is they're coming to learn English, but there are other motivating factors. You know, they're coming maybe for the experience. I mean, not everybody does yoga class it just solely because they want to learn yoga. There's also, well, they socialize with the other students. And maybe the yoga teacher occasionally says a funny anecdote and they like that experience. And they like to get involved in the culture
element
of
to it.
India. Yeah. Or, well, yeah, the meditation.
You know, right, health, so there's, and fitness, and it's a community.
The idea is it's multifaceted, and I think language teaching is definitely set up to be something like that as well, you know, which is why I think me and Neil are so interested in these people that do things a bit differently, because, you know, that is obviously that's a magnet for the customers that those people have, you know. Why would somebody want to have Jamie Keddy style lessons or John Kay style lessons? Yeah. Well, you know, this idea of the poetry for John and all that, and then you know, Jamie does his storytelling, exactly. He even teaches storytelling now.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I couldn't agree more. Like I was reading about something as well recently about learners, just how the niche doesn't have to be the English, like I was using examples like engineers and stuff, just because I think people can kind of relate to that. But the niche could be, like you say, but it could be you want to learn English through storytelling. Yeah.
Right.
You want to learn it. Another one that's really nice at the moment is like this international communication thing that's happening, and this real revolution in our industry and awareness of like English as an international language, and English as a lingua franca, and how important that is for our learners. So these classes which are like, do you want to learn English with someone from a totally different language background to you, who might be similar in terms of like maybe business profile, or maybe like you know, maybe you want to like three people who are like from different walks of life, but they have a similar, maybe they're all business owners, but like, I mean, they're not learning English for their business, they're learning it just to progress. But you know, you've got a Japanese learner, you've got a Spanish learner and a Brazilian learner, and they're getting together and they're, and the class is about international communication. So that could be the niche, do you know what I mean? Or it could be, like in our case, what we do is we focus a lot at the moment. We find out what the learners, sort of, we have an idea of what the teachers want, kind of classes the teachers want to teach on the course. And then we find learners who want to take those kind of classes. Does that make sense? So we our current group of teachers wants to do task-based learning. They were already interested in it. And task-based learning is not mainstream, I would say, in most sort of contexts. It's used, it's definitely, teachers are encouraged, but it's not like a mainstream framework for English language.
For our viewers, could you kind of give like your definition or overview of what you would consider to be task-based learning?
I mean, this is the thing, it's not even one thing, but it is the idea of sort of fronting and putting primary the communicative bit, you know, the way a lot of teachers might do a kind of speaking activity at the end of their lessons, perhaps after having presented some grammar or language. task-based learning sort of says, put that at the front, let them do it, see how they do in it, and then help them with what they can't do, and then get them to do it again, maybe, if you're following some people's model of task-based learning. I mean, I'm simplifying massively. That's sort of how we certainly use it. But it's the idea of like, almost like PPP flipped, you might call it sometimes. Mm-hmm. It's like...
Yeah, I kind of agree with that. Yeah. One of the things I really like about it is how the it's encouraging the students themselves to notice the gap. And that is really, it kind of goes into this idea of, you know, the interlanguage and the natural progression of a student's language, rather than you saying prescriptively, okay, now you're going to learn the third conditional. Instead, it's kind of like, no, have a chat about something. Oh, you found it a bit difficult to talk about that. Well, now let's analyze like someone who's, you know, a bit more sophisticated with their language talking about it. Oh, look at that, look at that. And they kind of notice these useful little language bits, take it for themselves. And it's got that element of potential for like autonomous learning, hasn't it? Because that's a skill that they could then apply when they go out in the real world.
Definitely. I think it has loads of potentials, or like affordances, you might call it, but it's not without its pitfalls. And it's certainly not like something that I would say that everybody can implement in their classes. But it's something that is often encouraged. Yeah. So people say, try a bit of TBL for lots of reasons. So what we wanted to do with our, for example, our DIP candidates, is we wanted to show them, well, what would like a whole course look like of a TBL, where it's like 12 lessons, TBL. And how would you build the syllabus? How would you do assessment? How are you going to help the learners notice their progression? You know, these things that are really motivating for learners is not just what happens in the class. You know, it's the between the classes. We all know this. But with TBL, sometimes we just do it in a pocket. And then it's like, but I can't really do it all the time because, like, I mean, how would they know what they've learned? You know, it's all random and all this kind of stuff. So we did the, we're in the middle, well, we're towards the end of our 12-week course of TBL. And here it goes back to that niche thing. Sorry, that's my whole point here, Rich, was that, you know, maybe what we did was we advertised for learners who wanted to take a super conversation-driven class. So we knew that people who were signing up to this class, they're not going to be going like, oh, well, where's my grammar lesson? Or where's my, and we kind of made it clear. So I think that's the other way that niche can go for teachers. It's like, if you know what you're good at and you can do something really well, like, and this goes as well, maybe you're really good at like structure. Maybe you can teach like a really nice little structure course, you know, a grammar. I'm not saying, you know, throw PPP out the door. I think it has its place in the world. And especially in contexts I've worked in, you know, big, large classes, lots of situations, PPP is exactly what the learners need. And maybe
it's
they
what
need
they
like,
want as well sometimes.
Exactly. But
well,
the point
I think
is,
it's different levels as well. I think one of the things that I always had issues with the TBL is I teach really young kids, or I did in China, and they zero English, you know, like where are you from? I'm fine, thank you, kind of English. Task-based learning. I was like, well, how do you even do that with, you know, that level, because you're front loading basically, and then how would you even do that as a course, long sketches? Because I, you know, whenever I've touched upon it, it's always been, oh, we've got a special class today. I'd be interested to hear from you on two points: task-based learning when tackling students with just really low levels of English, beginners, like even zero English, if that's even possible, or as well as, you know, this, what are some ideas if you could share with your approach to a curriculum of task-based learning?
Yeah. So should I start with the low learners?
Yes.
Because I have some experience doing this. So I'll speak a little bit from experience and then I'll speak a little bit from teachers I've worked with. So first of all, I went to work in Saudi just for a short stint in Saudi doing some teacher training. And I was doing some CELTA, but what I found was I started watching the CELTA classes, the CELTA teachers teaching, and I was, this is, goes back to this thing I was saying about, you know, putting yourselves in teachers' shoes. And I found myself watching it going, oh my God, I've never taught this kind of context. They're beginners. There's a class of 40 to 60 learners. Like, how can I give feedback to these teachers? How can I help them like develop? I have no idea what's going on here. So I had the luxury of getting a class. They gave me a class to teach. Basically, they gave someone a break in their timetable, and I was able to go in and I taught in the mornings for a couple of days. And just the insight it gave me was just phenomenal. The beginners thing, you know, so beginners, 40 to 60 learners in the group. And I was, unsure how much I could get out of them, but I felt like I wanted to do the task-based thing. I wanted to do it because I felt like if I couldn't do it, then I could at least say to myself, okay, look, it's not possible. So I went in and we tended, what we took was like a really, I suppose, very minimal input, but still input. So the thing that people think about task-based is like when you do the first task, it has to be an output task. It has to be a speaking task. And that's kind of the example that I gave, wasn't it, before. But actually the first task that you do could be an input task. It could be read, it could be watch, or it could be listen. So what we started to do was loads of kind of like live listenings, mini little live listenings. You know what I mean by live listening? So that's where like the teacher would read something. So maybe I started a lesson by saying, you know, so my name's Emma. I'm from Dublin, but I live in London. And I arrived in Saudi Arabia, like at that stage, I think it was like 6 days ago. I'm staying in a hotel. And the learners would listen and they had to do like a bit of processing on that. That's kind of the level. When I say beginners, I mean, I guess even that was probably more like the A2 group. But, you know, really simple stuff we're talking about, you know, like, for example, then the learners would do something with that text. Usually it involves some kind of dictation, working towards a dictation, something like that.
Okay.
Where we focused in on language. Yeah. So you start with the text, for example, listen to this text about me. I'll read it. And then after they listen, they have to maybe answer a question. For example, the question might be something like, do you have any questions for me? So listen to my text. And then do you have any questions for me? Now, the questions came in Arabic. I didn't understand the questions, but I could work with the learners to figure out what they wanted to know. They wanted to know which hotel I was staying in. They wanted to know, was the food good? They wanted to know, you know, the things they wanted to know. Yeah. So then we have our text and we might read it again. And then this time the learners are dictating. So they have to write down exactly what I'm saying. And then suddenly we've worked maybe like 40 minutes in the lesson and they've got a text, which is my name is I'm from, but I live in I arrived, blah, blah, blah. And something else. So there's quite a lot of grammar in there. And you might think, oh, that's like lots and lots of grammar. But the learners are understanding. Because it's really clear from the context what's going on. And then we look at that grammar, but we maybe look at the bit that they're like struggling the most with. And the difference between me walking into that class and teaching them a bit of grammar and them doing this is that I get to see which grammar they need help with rather than me walking in and deciding that's the grammar that they need help with. Does that make sense?
It's almost a dogma task-based learning.
Yeah,
because sort of. You know, it's kind of you've got this. You're going in there with it, and it reveals itself as the lesson progresses, and you pivot to what's needed.
Exactly. And then by the end of the lesson, what you have is you have the learners producing really short texts, maybe two sentences. They stuck them around the walls of the room, and they had to walk around, read them, and guess who wrote the text. Yeah, so from their classmates. Who wrote it? They didn't use that. My name is, they wrote, my name is X. And then they wrote a little bit about themselves. And there you have like learners being able to do what they can do. Because I think the other big issue in a big class for me as a teacher is differentiation. And how do I make sure that the weakest learner is supported? But also, how do I make sure that the stronger learner is getting something from this class? And I find that a real challenge as a teacher in large classes. So that would be kind of an example of a pretty low level, probably like sort of just starting elementary stuff. And I wouldn't be interested if they, I wouldn't care if they couldn't do all the grammar in the text.
Yeah.
My interest is in helping them do something, you know, like, so everybody gets a little bit out of that class. Obviously I've massively simplified, but that might be a kind of shape of a TBL low level.
That's excellent. And how would you, how would you deal with the differentiation within that? Because obviously, I always find if a group's really low, then there's going to be low, 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 and then there's going to be low, or just kind of low.
I think, spectrum
of lows.
In something like that, a classic thing that I use in lessons is just a bit of self-diagnosis or self-assessment. I think learners can tell you very easily where they are on that scale. So after I read it the first time, I would ask something like, from 0 to 10, how much did you understand? Like 0 is I understood nothing. And 10 is I'm absolutely perfectly happy with that. And then from that number that they give you, you know where they're at. And you might put all the people with like 8s, 9s, or 10s, you might move them around the class so that they can become the kind of support if you wanted to do a kind of mixed differentiation thing. If you wanted all the strong learners to work together, you might put them all together, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And all the weak learners, etc. But I think we sometimes forget that learners can tell us quite a lot about where they're at with their own learning, you know?
I think one of the issues with dealing with low-level learners, especially for new teachers, you kind of feel like you need to teach because you don't have so much confidence. So you're kind of always trying to fill a void in a way. Mm-hmm. And it's really difficult to be a teacher and just kind of do as you do and just walk into the room and with the confidence that this will all go well. You know, when there's like zero English around. But it's, I totally agree with you because it gives kind of agency to the learners as they're kind of almost guiding you to what they need, and then you go oh well okay, so this is where you're at and this is how I'm going to respond. So it is more communicative learning in a way, because you're not just communicating language, you're communicating learning needs. One thing, I'm just going to segue a little bit because it came to mind and I wanted to bring it up before going into task-based learning in the curriculum, is so what we have, and I think we touched upon this with John Kay and Nicola, is in the spectrum of teachers, we seem to have the most experienced teachers working at the most esteemed places, the places that are most difficult for learners to access, and the learners that can access it often aren't the lowest,
the high end, or already
pretty good with their English, or at least have some level. Whereas the lowest end of the learners that don't have generally great English, I'm kind of thinking of China here, don't have the means and the money to pay for much in the way of teaching. So often what they get is, especially like in rural China, and why companies like VIP Kids, Magic Ears, all these got so big, was it was so much cheaper to get a teacher through their platform than to have a teacher fly in and etc. So you end up with maybe less experienced teachers, which is kind of, it came to mind because of your example you just given, that you've got these low-level learners of English with a very experienced teacher, and how well that worked together. Yet it's not paired that way in often real life in the dynamics of the market. I was just wondering if you could sort of speak on that.
I think that a good platform. I mean, this is sort of a bit of advice, I suppose, for teachers more than anything. It's like, how much support do teachers get, whatever platform it is? And I don't think they're all equal in terms of how, we've kind of been classing them. And I think obviously, Rich, you work for one that's much better, but this is the danger. We don't want to like kind of paint everyone with the same brush, but it's like one question that I would encourage when I work, especially with like CELTA candidates and things, the question is like, how much support will they give you to teach what you have to teach? I don't mean just materials, because your CELTA course will only get you so far in teaching. anything except your CELTA teaching practice group, right? And everybody knows that once you leave your CELTA course, you're not going to be teaching 12 lovely learners from a mix of lovely nationalities or from, you know, if you're in one country, like 12 lovely Spanish students who are motivated to come every day, you're not going to be doing that.
What?
Unless
that doesn't exist.
You happen to walk into that like kind of role, but it's highly unlikely, you know, given the number of people doing CELTA courses. So my point is, I would hope that teachers are a little bit discerning, maybe, and I would encourage my teachers to be a bit discerning and to feel like a bit like they have the right to ask these questions. You know, like, are you going to help me to teach that context, that group? Because yeah, like, it's not just, or it shouldn't just be rock up, read out the book. And if it is rock up, read out the book, or rock up, read out the PowerPoint, and that's it, that's all that they want you to do, then that's not really a job that you really want to be jumping into, I think, you know. And I think some platforms are better than others at this, you know. Some will give you more support than others. And if they're not giving you anything, but the job still looks good, I think you have to spend a bit of time as a teacher getting yourself into that like context mode, you know, and not just thinking like my CELTA course is going to help me to teach this lesson. And that's not to say that you can't do it, you know, of course you can do it. We can all learn really quickly, but I think, you know, yeah, that's how we've all learned, isn't it? We've all jumped into the situation and gone, oh, I'll just do my blah, blah, blah lesson. And then it's like, or whatever. But I suppose to answer the question is like, yeah, first of all, maybe try to be a bit discerning if you can, and look for support from the organization if you can. I would hope that they would offer something to you. Any kind of reasonable organization should be offering you a little bit of support. And if they don't, maybe like try to find it. There's so many amazing resources out there now. Like, I can't get over the explosion in resources that have happened, you know. If you join something like LinkedIn and search for what, like, for example, teaching large classes or whatever, you're going to find some really great advice about that kind of thing. And don't feel that you have to throw babies out with bathwaters, you know. Just there's a thing. I'm not sure if I'm answering your question at all, Neil. Sorry.
It's quite tricky sometimes to actually determine that, you know, up front. I mean, I've had experiences throughout my career of both organizations that seem to present themselves in that sort of way. But when I got there, the experience was not entirely positive. And then I've also had the experience of, in fact, probably the best place that I ever worked as a teacher in terms of development. I didn't really have an idea that that's what it was going to be like beforehand. I kind of, you know, they presented a bit of that. But when I actually started working there, it was a summer school. I worked there 4 years in a row. And it was just amazing. I don't know what it was about the environment there, but they were really focused on development. And everyone seemed kind of excited about it as well. It was like, you know, the kind of this excitement that you sometimes get on teacher training courses, I think, this kind of excitement of trying something new and doing something new. And it was there. And I think that for me is like, that's it's like the X factor of an institution. You know, if you can work somewhere where there's almost this kind of excitement about teaching and doing stuff, you know, people chat about their lessons and kind of have a good time. You know, it's like it's the opposite to that thing where someone mentions lessons and then someone else at the table says, don't talk shop outside. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's, you know, it's the opposite to that. People actually want to talk about the things they've been doing in class. And I love that.
I actually think it's I totally agree with you there, Emma. It really is about for teachers to discern and kind of to be honest in reflection of where they are at or why are they doing it. Because I don't think that there is anything wrong with, you know, these companies that just, you know, like, it's online learning, they give you a PowerPoint and you just go through that and, you know, and that's how they keep their costs low. That's how they don't have to pay teachers so much, because the value isn't on the how experienced and how good that teacher is. They're just kind of another tool. They're just another tool to deliver the product. And one of the, you know, I think one of the things that we many teachers often get caught up in is this romanticized idea of being a teacher. But you know, there are some people that just see it as a job and can be part of that clog. And if someone wants to do that, I'm happy with them doing that, just as long as they follow what the company wants to do, and that's fine. And I actually think this is probably going to end up being how many become accidental Tefflers going forward. They'll be doing this and be like, actually, I think I can do a little bit more apps out of that. And that's hope, you know, our channel and Dublin Teffel will step in and go, okay, so what can I do that's a little bit different? Mm-hmm. How can I establish my own brand, and how can I diverge from there? So I really do think that all these worlds aren't so different. It's just you kind of have to be honest with yourself as to why you're doing it, but also really discern with businesses as well, because they are businesses. So you will get International House, you will get Oxford University, and you all get magic ears all saying we are a teaching education company. There's degrees, and don't just listen to the sales, but be very discerning with that.
Yeah, I think it's like that blinkers thing. It's like, don't, and also, you know, just know what you're getting yourself into as well. You know, don't, like I said, you know, it's like, this is what they want you to do, and you will do it. And if you don't want to do it, don't do it then, you know. I mean, like, it's that, you know. It's like, and I think these platforms are like the new hog one. No, they're the new and so a year later it's like, actually I could do a pretty good job on this, I reckon, you know, if I had a bit more time. And
it's fun, because I mean, you know, it's not that difficult to have a conversation with someone. And especially if you're dealing with kids, it's just fun. It's just fun to talk with kids in general. And then you go, well, actually, you know, maybe if I can have a good conversation with them, but also I can do a little bit, maybe I can guide it a little bit, and maybe they learn a little something. And then you start to get that itch, and you end up doing podcasts like this. But I'd like to go kind of back to the TBL, and you talked about developing a course. I think that that's going to be really interesting, not just for myself, but, you know, for our viewers and for our listeners as well, because, you know, I know a lot of people that want to get into that, but, you know, how do they even do that? Especially, I get a lot of people that are English teachers that are non-native as well. So develop that and put that together, I think would be really interesting for them.
I think there's like two big pieces of advice that I'd give. One is for course setting up the course, how you set up the course. So a task is only as good as how interested the learners are going to be in doing the task. You know, tasks are motivating if the learners want to do them. I mean, if you put me in a class and said, plan your fantasy football team, Emma, in Spanish, I'm sorry, but I wouldn't be very engaged in that task. Yeah, but so that's just something, you know, as an example. But there are lots of people who would find that absolutely super interesting, and that would be exactly what gets them engaged. Yeah, so at the early stages of course planning, literally when you get these learners, when you found them, however many they are, you have to find out what does motivate them. You have to find out what they want to do. And not just in that, like, oh yeah, I really want to improve my English. Brilliant. Why? I want to speak to people in English. Brilliant. Okay, that's not going to help you. That's not going to help you design a task-based course, because you don't know who they want to speak to. You don't know what they want to talk about. You don't know where they're going to be with their English or where they see themselves being. So my top tip here is use some kind of needs analysis device, like maybe a future you visualization, something like that. So the idea here would be get the learners to imagine themselves in a year's time. Maybe you can do it. I often do it in the class, like, as in class, everyone closes their eyes, turns off their camera, spend a few minutes talking them through the visualization. It's a year's time. You're speaking English. Who are you speaking to? What are you talking about? You're reading a bit of English. What are you reading? Why are you reading it? What are you going to do with that information? So this is something that is super, super powerful, this future self vision, you might call it. And we try to tap into it early in a course, like with, especially with task-based learning, because what you get to extract from the answers when everybody shares their future selves, you get to find out where the overlap in what they want to do is, what they want to talk about. So for example, on the course we're running at the moment, in one of the classes, because we're running two classes, one of them, the future was all about like watching movies and listening to podcasts and talking to people from other countries, mostly kind of online, really. They don't want to travel much. I suppose they can't really imagine travel. But they want to kind of be part of an online community of English speakers who are like watching films, watching TV series. So we've kind of designed the course around that, you know. So the course is about being able to understand a bit of a TV program. So you're working on like listening skills and maybe a bit of vocabulary, things like that. Yeah. So you've built the course around the tasks that lead to their future selves. Yeah. So that's my first tip, is make sure your needs analysis helps you extract what tasks might work if you want to do a task-based approach. Because if you don't have good tasks, it's going to fall flat on its face. And then the second thing is keep really good records of what's going on in your lessons. And my top tip for keeping good records is using a lesson summary device. So getting the teacher of the class to basically write like a half an A4 page, usually, or maybe an A4 page, which summarizes what happened in the lesson and embeds into it all the like target language that comes up, or all the emergent language grammar phrases. And we do it like on a Google Doc thing. So we can also include like voice notes of pronunciation support, things like that. And lesson summaries then basically become like a kind of retrospective syllabus, because what you get from a lesson summary is you find out what happened. So then when you're planning assessment, you can very easily come up with assessment, because assessment is, because the course is written down. And one of the problems with task-based learning and any kind of very reactive approach to teaching is people find it hard to assess it, because it's like, what happened? How did it happen? But by keeping kind of quite thorough lesson summaries, and sorry, we share them with the learners. So the learners have access to these. They read them, they use them to study, to develop. And there's always embedded tasks, you know, like things we've embedded into the lesson summary. So now we're on like lesson 10. So we've got 10 of these summaries and we're coming to the end of the course. There'll be a bit of assessment. We're going to set some Flipgrid video tasks for the learners to do based on, you know, things that have come up in the course so far. There'll be some Quizlet. We're going to do some Quizlet vocabulary. What do you call them? Exams. I want to call them exams. Quizzes. They're called quizzes. Yeah. Some quizzes which will review all the vocabulary. So we'll be able to assess kind of vocabulary retention that way. But these lesson summaries, they're just like really simple, you know, narratives of what happened. They take no time to prepare. You do them after the lesson. They take no time at all, but they become a really, really good record of learning of what happened. And they're a good way for teacher development as well, because if your summary is kind of short and there's not much language in it, you're like, oh, I didn't really teach much today, did I? Mm-hmm. So they're quite a good, they're a good tool for the teachers to kind of be reflecting on their own practice. And that's something that I did steal from Kerry Jones, because I am a master thief. yes, thank you, Kerry, for those lesson summary ideas. She taught a Dogma course many years ago to a group of... what do you call them? Like older learners? Seniors. Seniors. Although, yeah, I'm not sure about that word. But she taught a group of older learners in Spain with total dogma, like no plan at all. And she used them to record the syllabus as it emerged. And I think any teacher who wants to work reactively, it's just a really simple technique you can implement with your learners. Really powerful, in our experience and in my experience as well.
No, I think that's absolutely fantastic advice, and I agree with that, especially with the reactive. It's one of those ones where with no course book and no, I mean there is a plan, but with no course book or curriculum, it can kind of. That's often the problem that you get, especially, you know, when you've got young learners and their parents, well, they want to know what's happened. So by keeping that summary, you know, it helps them understand that there is progression and what happened. And, you know, it's better than just circling, you know, sentences that they've done and all that sort of jazz. But it's very interesting. And what you brought up about on your first point is it's very, I mean, the visualization, that's NLP, that was like the John Kay stuff that we've talked about previously. It's very interesting how that converges, but it makes a lot of sense because it's linguistic. But the idea of getting them to tell you what it is that they like and then fulfilling that is kind of like a very business business concept, in that you approach a business, oh, what is your need, and then you create a solution for that need. So there's a whole lot of stuff in there where you can kind of see, if you're a teacher watching, that you want to be having a mindset of, well, what skills do you have? What, you know, how does that relate to some learners that you're targeting? Talk to those learners, find out what it is that interests them, what it is that they want. You know, visualization is that great technique, and then give it to them. It doesn't have to be more difficult than that. You're just fulfilling the need, and that's the market. That's how it works.
Yeah.
So finding that level of engagement is definitely critical, isn't it? Yeah. So what can you do to engage learners? And people have their different things. That's where all these different styles come from, really, isn't it? I mean, personally, the thing that I've been doing quite a lot of recently is this kind of like pseudo CLIL. I don't want to call it actual CLIL, but it's sort of pseudo CLIL, like a lesson where you kind of learn about something new. It tends to be kind of based on something I've been doing myself. Because I don't know about you, Emma, but during the lockdown, I basically took up like a million and one new hobbies and started doing all this stuff. So I was like making my own homemade wine, and I've like made my own sauerkraut and all this sort of stuff. And these things these things can be surprising. They can make like fantastic material for English classes. So I've really got into that, and this kind of like sciencey history based stuff. I really like doing that.
Very
stuff.
On trend as well. This clearly, as you call it, like CLIL adjacent, you know, like CLIL has a bad name sometimes, but I think as well, like CLIL with, I don't know whether you're working with like adults or not, but CLIL with adults is just like a massive area that hasn't really been explored, I think, properly.
I work with adults.
Really motivating.
I mean, I think they really appreciate it because they come away from it and go, ah, there's something new, and it wasn't necessarily just the English, you know.
I know, if I reflect on my own Spanish learning, like the stuff that I learned, I remember going to a wine tasting once it was in Catalan. It was kind of mixed Spanish and Catalan. I didn't speak Catalan, but Spanish was used as a supporting language. But the amount I learned was just phenomenal. It was a 2-hour. You know, it wasn't a language lesson, by the way. I learned about wine. But you walk away with all this language. And I think from a motivation point of view, it's an area that I think has got real potential for tapping in, because as humans, we love learning. We love it. And the language can get a bit heavy. It can get a bit demotivating because language is a bit hard, you know. Language learning is hard. It's really tough for most people. But learning about stuff is kind of cool. I think that's
you can kind of piggyback on there in a way. I think that's kind of where our industry can step in, because maybe you aren't the number one person, or even in the anywhere remotely top echelon of, you know, being a best social media guy or something like that, but you are an experienced English teacher and you offer a course to teach social media via English or something like that, then you're mirroring both of those skills. There's that's actually a big Tim Ferriss thing. He talks about that the thing moving forward is converging skills together. So, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. not just having one skill set, but being able to combine them and cross them over. So that's what you're kind of seeing with all these academics right now, where you see someone like Sam Harris, for example, neuroscientist, philosopher, but also a great speaker. Those are two separate skills that have been combined to create this new thing. This I'm not so niche, but, you know, being multifaceted and multi-skilled. And I think that's going to start applying to our industry moving forward.
Yeah, one of the things that me and you kind of want to get onto at some point, Neil, isn't it, with the podcast, is you want to start talking to people in general education. Because, you know, I don't know what you think about this, Emma, but I've always thought that the pedagogy in English language teaching, especially at the kind of top level, although we have the bad reputation of the backpacker industry, you know, once people have took an interest and invested in these different things, I think the pedagogy is really kind of top notch, you know, when you get a good language teacher, you know. And, you know, I don't know if I'm doing a disservice to general education, but, you know, my memories of the way people taught was they weren't particularly using these sort of understandings of how people learn that we use today. And I very recently did a master's course in university, and I don't particularly have anything good to say about the pedagogical techniques used in postgraduate courses at university. So for me, I think there's a lot that, you know, even if we are, you know, as you say, the industry language teachers don't have the most prestigious reputation, I feel like we have something to teach the teachers of other areas, to be honest. Yeah. And I wonder if there's a way that these two worlds can come together a little bit.
I mean, I think absolutely. And I know exactly what you mean about that, like feeling far ahead of the game. I think maybe more recently things are not catching up, but developing in the mainstream education. I do know a little bit about this from experience, but it's the classic thing. I mean, working as a CELTA tutor, you get a trainee on the course who's come from mainstream education. They do a CELTA course and they're like, I've learned more in a month than I learned on my, you know, two years PGC. Yeah. You know, it's not a coincidence. I mean, that's said by many, many, many people, and it's kind of anecdotal, but also I think it there's something going on there. But this idea of, like, we do have a good understanding when we've developed as teachers, and, you know, the levels of teachers are obviously different, but yeah, when we understand learning, when we talk about learning in language teaching, we talk about it, really, you know, like how we learn, we're interested in it. People might have different approaches, different methods, but the conversation is happening in a way that maybe it isn't always happening in education, in mainstream education, or not for everybody, because they are much more bogged down in paperwork and procedural stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's just really, it's like quite overwhelming for those teachers. But I think for teachers watching, maybe, or people who are interested, I mean, personally, I found that being on LinkedIn in the last year or so has just incredible connections between fields, you might call them, as Neil said. Right. So I follow people from various fields, and the positive impact it's had on my own professional growth is just outstanding. You know, I'm very interested in, for example, instructional design. So I've learned a lot about, like, instructional design, but instructional design isn't really, you know, connected, isn't a TEFL thing. You know, yes, I do design courses for teaching and courses for learning, but there's a whole field of instructional design that has very sound principles and pedagogy, if you like, underneath it. And I've learned a lot from that. And I've learned a lot from being connected with people in mainstream education. So I think for teachers, this idea of diversification, as Neil says, like sort of multifaceted, how can we develop ourselves? I think joining, like, professional learning communities, as they call them, is so much more possible now, and so rich in terms of what you can get out of it, you know? We live in a very kind of, just full of things world, you know, things that if we want them, we can have them very quickly. And in terms of our development, that's a great thing, I think.
Oh, it's absolutely fantastic. And, you know, what I feel so, sounds cliche, blessed to be where I am now in terms of technology and internet access to information. It's just fantastic. It's great. And there's no limit to it. The only limit is your curiosity and desire to learn. Mm-hmm. And my only, not not fear, but my only thing that I worry about is that the mainstream education, the especially public education, is falling behind to everything that's been put out there. You know, like we're talking about this sort of thing. I'm not sure how much that is actually happening within, you know, the education system. And a lot of, like, you know, as a parent as well, I'm looking, I use a lot of techniques that I have, you know, with raising, you know, my child. And I do that on, I've put that on Team Teacher Baby, or I will be more going forward with that. But, you know, there's a lot of people are just kind of working this out themselves. And it's outside of the education system. And they are doing a very good job of, you know, early learning, you know, putting, being able to condense ideas and put them on Instagram for people to easily use. However, there is kind of, is this best practice instances to that? And it's just unfortunate that the mainstream education or public education is not more involved with that to guide it more.
Yeah, I think that's very country-based, isn't it? Countries, like, well, you know, we can only speak from the countries we personally, I can speak from the countries that I've lived in or had been in education myself, you know, or had someone in education, like one of my kids or whatever. But I do think that that is a difference between countries, you know, how on it the public or the state or the national curriculum or whatever you want to call it is in those, like, shall we call them, I don't know, up to date or whatever you want to call it, approaches and methods varies greatly.
But it leaves more room for private businesses to pursue this, and people will move that. I mean, how many kids, how many parents are sending their kids not to just general daycare, but to Montessori, to Waldorf, to all these different ones, because they're like, this is how I think it should work. And, you know, it's often supported by that. And generally, early childhood learning is actually pretty up to date, I found myself in many respects. But, you know, maybe going on.
I think Jeremy Harmer said this at a talk actually a couple of years ago. He was talking about, you know, the can of worms of the future of community of language teaching. Obviously, people have been talking about it at conferences for about the past 25 years, and he was talking about it, and he was going on about the change that might be required to survive the oncoming challenges. Little did he know about the oncoming pandemic. And he spoke about how the big institutions were like those oil tankers on the horizon, kind of grinding along, moving super slow. And then he spoke about how, you know, we as individuals or small businesses or whatever can be like little speedboats, you know. As you've mentioned before, Neil, we can pivot. So there's kind of more opportunity to explore these other ways of doing things. Mm-hmm. Institutional change takes a long time, but individuals can sort of innovate.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of like potential for sort of more bottom up, shall we call it?
Yeah.
Especially nowadays, again, with the access, with the connections. I think teachers, and not just myself, but who I've talked to, just feeling more connected, and if you're not feeling connected, then like there's possible, you know, maybe you need to reflect on why, but there's so many ways that you can and things you can find, like where your passion is within that bottom-up process of teaching and development. And I think for me that's really the future as well of teaching and teacher development, is teacher driven, not institutionally driven. And
And I think that is an absolute perfect segue into wrapping this up and you giving your final thoughts on, you know, being a titan of teacher training and development. How can teachers and other learners, viewers, you know, get in touch with you? And go ahead.
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you so much. Sorry, Neil, for interrupting. Thank you so much, Rich for reaching out. Oh, that's a nice fun, isn't it?
Yeah.
Rich reached out.
Reach out, Rich.
Yeah, that's there we go.
Oh, I've got it for next time.
And yeah, Neil as well. It's been a really enjoyable chat. And I think the way that I see the world right now is super, super hopeful in terms of our industry. I think I see so many possibilities for teachers. In the things that have happened that maybe felt like really stressful at the time, you know, like a year ago, things felt like being imposed upon and all this kind of stuff. And as we step out of that thing, you know, remember that thing that happened? Yeah. As I step out of it, I think like hopefully, and I know it because of the people I'm working with, there's like slightly maybe like light bulbs going off. And I think for teachers to just follow those light bulbs is really important. Because there's so many possibilities, you know, like, and they can be the driver of their own development. There are things out there in the world, in the internet that they can access. There are learning communities, Facebook, you know, put in a group that you want to join on Facebook, you'll find it. I've learned so much in the last like 6 months from different communities that I'm involved in. And yeah, just like follow your spark, you know, that kind of way, I suppose. That's my big advice for teachers, because then it'll be at least as good as it can be. Yeah. And you know, a career Teffler accidental career Teffler, yeah, it's possible.
And can you let us know how we get in touch with you?
Yes, so you can contact us. I think info@DublinTeffel is a good place to contact us by email if you're interested in individual CPD, or if you're interested in our DIP TESOL course, which we'll be starting. The next intake is October, so it's kind of in line with the academic year in lots of countries. We'll be running a kind of 9-month online program. Lots of things that we've talked about today are kind of covered in there, plus a whole lot more. It's an internationally recognized qualification and equivalent to a Delta. So lots of rigorous study, but also so much development. And I think, Rich, as a dipper, you'd give your thumbs up to it as a step in the career, you know, that you might want to take if that's the kind of spark that's been lit or whatever for you. If that's where
I very much felt like the CELTA was a piece of paper that I was kind of, because I was like you, I went into it after I had been teaching for a few years. It was kind of a piece of paper I was getting to show to employees. Not that I didn't get anything out of it. I think I learned how to write a good lesson plan. But then the diploma was something I just enjoyed pretty much from start to finish. Mm-hmm. It was thoroughly enjoyable and really opened up kind of a world of teaching, which previously I just thought, you know, oh, well, this is the CELTA way. This is how you do it. And then mm-hmm. you discover all these other kind of possibilities. Yeah
And I think from the DIP point of view, the journey is really important, but for lots of teachers the piece of paper is also very important, so it does open so many doors.
Yes, it does.
It really does. But luckily, or I suppose, you know, fortunately, it's an incredible process to go through, and we very much enjoy supporting teachers go through that in Dublin TEFL. So if you're interested, check us out at dublinteffel.com or send us an email at info@dublinteffel.
That's fantastic. Thank you for coming on to the show. It's been just an absolute pleasure. And, you know, hopefully we'll see you on the show again sometime.
Thanks again, guys.
Bye-bye.